Good. And now, if you've got Bibles, you might want to have a look at John chapter 21. And this is the last in a series of sermons on disciple. And I want to read the first, I think it might be 17 or 19 verses. Afterwards, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, which is another name for the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, called Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. "Well, I'm going out to fish," Simon Peter told them. And they said, "We'll go with you." So they went out and they got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples didn't realize that it was Jesus. He called out to them, "Friends, haven't you any fish?" "No," they answered. He said, "Throw your net onto the right side of the boat and you'll find some." When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, "It's the Lord," he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off, and he jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. And Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you've just caught." Simon Peter climbed aboard and he dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish, 153. But even with so many, the net wasn't torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. So Jesus came, he took the bread and gave it to them and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. And when they finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" "Well, yes, Lord," he said. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me?" He answered, "Well, yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." And the third time Jesus said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter was hurt because Jesus had asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep. I tell you the truth, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. When you're old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." And Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. And then he said to him, "Follow me. Follow me." One of the great cricketers of a bygone era was a Yorkshireman called Len Hutton. On one occasion, Len Hutton was meeting a group of schoolboys. And one of the lads, keen to impress, proudly announced, "Sir, I've never been out for a duck. I've never been out for no runs at all." He thought that the great man would be hugely impressed, but he wasn't. What he said was, "Well, you've not played much cricket then, lad." In other words, you don't get very far in any kind of endeavor without some experience of failure. If you've never failed, you've never lived. There was a television series honoring the pioneers of surgery some years ago. It was about men who a couple of hundred years back or so were not prepared to stand by and watch injured men die and do nothing about it. So in the era before anesthetics, before antibiotics, before antiseptics, without much understanding what they were doing, they got out their knives and their swords and they had a go. Most times, the men they were trying to save died anyway. But without them, the message of the television series was that modern surgery would never have developed. Our successes are built on their failures. The series that had the title, The Courage to Fail. The Courage to Fail. A couple of weeks back, Chris Lawrence was preaching about faith. And he was quoting John Wimber as saying that the faith is spelled R-I-S-K. And with risk comes failure, at least not all of the time, but some of the time, certainly. So that faith equals risk, and risk is going to lead to failure at times at any rate. And I want to suggest that there is a sense in which God honors failure. It's failure that I want to talk about this morning. And if that sounds crazy, then I invite you to look no further than Simon Peter. When you read the Gospels, one of the striking things, to me at any rate, is the way that it shows not just the successes of the 12 disciples, but also their failures. And in the failure states, there is one man who stands head and shoulders above all of the rest. And that man is Simon Peter. He fails more than anybody. He's the guy who tries and fails to walk on water. He is the guy who volunteers an answer to Jesus' question, who do you think I am? And it's the right answer. And then he promptly goes on to spoil it by trying to talk Jesus out of going to the cross. I know better. He fails. He's the guy who announces that whatever the other disciples do, he, Simon Peter, will never, ever, ever in a whole lifetime deny Jesus or let him down. And then he promptly does exactly that. Peter is the failure par excellence. But who is it that Jesus chooses as leader of the 12? Well, it's Simon Peter, isn't it? It is the failure. And in Jesus' eyes, the failure is the man most qualified to lead. And it's important to recognize that, because often it is exactly the fear of failure that hamstrings and inhibits us. We're afraid of failing, so we do nothing. In the economy of Jesus, failure is not the worst thing in the world that can happen. In fact, failure is part of the process by which he shapes us to become his authentic disciples. It's a learning experience, and there are a number of things that failure will teach us if we let it. I want to mention four of them. First of all, it teaches us need. John chapter 15 and verse 5, Jesus says, if you abide in me, you will bear much fruit, but without me, you can do nothing. Without me, you can do nothing. Now, that isn't where most of us begin. Many of us begin with a self-confidence that says, I can do this. I have the abilities, I have the charisma, I have the personality, whatever it is, I can do it. And failure is often what it takes to teach us that we can't. In Mark chapter 9, Jesus heals a boy who's oppressed by an evil spirit. He is deaf, he's dumb. He's hugely self-destructive. He's suicidal. The boy has so many problems, you can scarcely begin to enumerate all of them. Jesus is not the first person to try and help the lad. The disciples had got there first. And the man, when he actually finds Jesus, says, I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they couldn't do it. And later on, after the incident is all over, after Jesus has gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, why couldn't we do it? Why couldn't we drive out the spirit? They tried and they failed. And failure drives them back to Jesus to seek the resources that they now know they don't have. And in verse 29, Jesus says, this kind can only come out by prayer. And some manuscripts say prayer and fasting. It may be that Jesus said prayer and fasting. It may be that he just said prayer. But there is a radical dependence on God for this healing that the disciples hadn't previously recognized. And it's failure that brings them to that recognition. And one thing that failure should do for us is to teach us that we cannot do it by ourselves. We need the Lord. The second thing that failure should be teaching us is teachability. Jesus tells the 12 about his impending death in Mark chapter 8 and verse 31. But Peter's not having any of it. He knows better than that. So he comes back at Jesus in verse 32. Jesus told them plainly about his death, but Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. And again, it comes naturally to, for many of us to go through this through life with this attitude that I'm right. I know best. And Jesus has to correct Peter. In verse 33, he turns and looks at his disciples. He rebukes Peter, "Get behind me, Satan." He says, "You don't have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." And when it all happens and Jesus is arrested and crucified, I'm pretty sure that Simon Peter would have sat down and pondered the fact that what had seemed so obvious to him, that the Messiah shouldn't suffer, that he should be a great king, that everything should go well and swimmingly, or he shouldn't die, that what had seemed so obvious to him was in fact completely wrong and Jesus was completely right. And failure should teach us not just to ask for help, but also to reckon with the fact that through life we might be wrong. Failure doesn't do that. It's failed in its job. Third thing that failure is designed to teach us is humility. It is an awful lot harder to pose when you've got egg on your face. You can see in the 12 disciples a huge degree of competitiveness amongst them, vying with each other to see who's the best, who's the top dog, who's going to be the leader, who's going to have the top place in heaven, all this sort of stuff. It gets harder to do that when you've been in total panic together in a storm on a lake, or when you've tried to walk on water and you've ended up sinking, or when you've got things comprehensively wrong, or when you've sat with the other disciples too proud to do the foot washing job after a long day's journey, only to find that Jesus, the leader, does it for you. All of those are failures. All of them must surely have led to humility. All of those failures should bring you to a point where you lose the sense of superiority and you start cutting other people a bit of slack. I get things wrong. And I know that other people are liable to as well. Failure should teach us humility. The fourth thing that failure teaches us is success. Because often it's our failures that teach us the most. We learn how not to do things the next time. We learn how to depend on the Lord and not ourselves, to listen to God and to each other. Back to the pioneers of surgery, it's the failures as well as the successes that enabled them to see what would work and what would not work. And I believe that it is no accident that when you read the early chapters of Acts, there is one man above all who is able to do some amazing works of power which open doors for the gospel. A man who gets an incredible number of things right, and his name is Simon Peter. And his failures in the gospels are the foundation for a tremendous success in his ministry in Acts. And as you and I grow as disciples of Jesus Christ, failure is part of the process, guys. It's painful, but it is unavoidable. And it may sometimes feel like the end of the world for us, but in God's eyes, it is anything but that. In fact, when you look at the Bible, it is God's book of failures, isn't it? Abraham, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, David, Solomon, Jeremiah. You could go on and on and on from one end of the Bible to the other. Most of the heroes of Scripture were not guys who never got anything wrong, but they're guys who learnt from their failures and they allowed God to shape them through them. So failure is part of the discipling process. Sometimes failure goes to a different level, doesn't it? Sometimes we hit a failure that feels so deep, so long-lasting that it seems to define us forever. It's not just something just that is a verb, something that we did, but it's an identity, it's a noun, it's who we are. And we feel utterly destroyed by it. And I think that's where Simon Peter is at the beginning of John chapter 21. His whole life, his whole raison d'etre is following Jesus Christ. He's given up everything to do that. That is the total of what he's about. He's given to Jesus the pledge that he, Simon Peter, will stand with his Lord to the ends of the earth, come hell or high water. Nothing will stop me from standing by you, Lord. Of course, you know the story that Jesus is arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's taken to the residence, bound hand and foot to the residence of the high priest. And Peter follows. I suppose there's credit in that, isn't it? And Peter's standing in the courtyard. He's warming himself by the fire because it's a cold, cold night. He's wondering what on earth he can do. His sword by his side, because this is outside anything that he's experienced before. And he can understand a sort of, you have a good old hack at people and fisticuffs and all that sort of stuff. But this is something that's outside his life's experience. He doesn't know what to do. When one of the servant girls peers into his face, she says, "You're one of his friends, aren't you?" Peter, I think, is not afraid of the servant girl, but the courtyard is full of people who are liable to be hostile. So he says, "Oh, no, no, not me, not me. Actually, I don't know what you're talking about." And as this girl goes around the courtyard, she makes conversation with some of the bystanders. I'm sure he was with the Galilean, you know. Do you see them together? I thought I saw them together. And now Simon Peter is rattled. He raises his voice. No, I wasn't. I don't know him. And you know, when you raise your voice, sometimes what happens is that your accent comes to the fore. And that happens with Peter. And this now has become a major topic of conversation. Everyone is looking his way. Listen to his Galilean accent. You're a northerner. You've got to be one of his friends. And now he is absolutely in panic. He curses. He swears, "I don't bleep, bleep know the man." All because of a servant girl. Sometimes failure can seem so destructive that you wonder whether there can be life and ministry beyond it. Failure in a marriage. Failure in your ministry or your work for God. Failure as a parent. That's a painful one, isn't it? You see everything that matters to you in your life seemingly stagnant or useless. Or perhaps you've made some awful decision that leaves your world in tatters. Or perhaps you struggle with little or no success with some secret sin that keeps on dogging you year after year, and you're too ashamed to admit it to any other human being. And I'm imagining that most of us who are over 30 years old have been somewhere like that at some point in our lives. Some really serious sense of failure. And in John chapter 20, 21, Jesus is risen and he's appeared to the 12 on a number of occasions, but things have gone quiet for a bit, and Simon Peter is a man who is desperate to forget, not to forget Jesus, but to forget him and his past. In fact, he will do almost anything to get that awful night of failure out of his head. So with nothing to do, he says, "Guys, I'm going fishing. Let's at least get busy doing something that I know how to do. I will not fail at this. I might have failed at any number of other things, but I won't fail at this." Six of the others join him. The night, of course, is a total disaster, as you know. Not a single fish caught. A big fat zero. And then a stranger on the shore tells them to put down the net on the other side of the boat. "Try on the right-hand side." And suddenly they're inundated with a catch of fish that they can scarcely cope with. 153 fish. Now, actually, there's a message in those 153 fish. And the message is both a positive one and a negative one. Negatively, the stranger has shown that these lifelong fishermen cannot even do what they're best at without his help. They cannot even do what they're best at without his help. But positively, it's a reminder of a call that they'd had 3 years earlier when he's saying, "I'll make you fishermen of men. I'll enable you to bring people into a living relationship with Jesus." And at this moment, above all, this moment of personal failure, those words have a hollow ring. It's never going to happen, is it? But, you know, this bunch of failures changed the world. Impossible, impossible, impossible. But the stranger's help reminds them that in God's kingdom, the impossible can happen. And yes, maybe, just maybe, there is a future for them. Maybe they can be fishermen of men. The stranger, of course, is Jesus. Jesus, whom Simon Peter is longing to see again, but also desperate to avoid. And it's a kind of, I think, a kind of awkward breakfast together there on the side of the lake. And after the breakfast is finished, Jesus turns directly to Peter, looks him straight in the eye. He says, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these others?" And the first thing that Simon Peter notices is that Jesus has ditched his nickname. He hasn't said Peter. He isn't calling him the rock anymore. Jesus knows about Simon Peter's failure, about his panic, about his threefold denial, all the shame that goes with it. He knows all of that. So Simon gives him the answer. "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." It is an answer that doesn't exactly reflect the question, because when Jesus asks, "Do you love me?" he's using a strong word for love, agape. This is a love that lays down your life for another human being. "Peter, do you have that kind of love for me?" When Simon Peter answers, he uses a rather weaker word, which is phileo. "You are my friend. You're my friend. I like you. I value you." He's no longer claiming to go to the ends of the earth for Jesus, to give up his life for him. He knows that his life has undermined the credibility of all that kind of rhetoric, so he doesn't use it. But he still wants to say, "Jesus, I care about you. I still want to follow you. I still want to be your man. I still want to belong to you. Yes, I am your friend." Then Jesus says, "Feed my lambs." In other words, he's saying, "Simon Peter, you have your job back. You have your job back. You may not believe in yourself, but I believe in you. You may think that I'm disillusioned with you after what you've done, which I know all about. Let me tell you, I never had any illusions in the first place, and when I called you, I knew you. You may think that you could never again have a place in serving me, but actually you do. And it's time to get back on the horse, to climb back onto the bicycle, to get back into the race. It is time to stand up and get moving again." Now, all of this happens with minor variations three times. Why three times? Because Jesus wants Peter to know that he knows the very depth of Peter's failure. Peter had denied Jesus three times. Jesus asked the question three times. And Jesus wants him to know that he, the Lord, is able to deal with the very worst that he has done. And what Jesus says to Peter is not because he doesn't understand how bad Peter's failure has been. He absolutely does. But it doesn't stop him from picking him up, dusting him down, and recommissioning. Look, this may not be relevant to lots and lots of people here today. I guess it probably isn't. But if you are at a place of brokenness and failure this morning, there are three things that you need to do. And the first one is face truth. There is no future in running away. God is a God of truth and reality, and that's the only currency that he deals in. He doesn't deal in pretense. He doesn't use the currency of "let's pretend." He's not a God who's interested in excuses or avoidance or escapism, and the answers to where you're at this morning don't lie in a pill or in a bottle or on the screen. What Jesus does with Peter, he wants to do with us. He wants to bring us face to face with the reality of where we've stuffed up in our lives. He wants us to know that he already knows the darkest secrets of our hearts, and he can cope with it. He can cope with it. So the first thing is we call it what it is. The second thing that we do is we receive grace. Here's the amazing thing. That whatever fear or self-loathing there is in Simon Peter, Jesus wants him to know that he still loves him. He hasn't written him off. He still seeks his friendship. He's still reaching out to him. The fishing expedition might have been Peter's way of running away from himself and Jesus, but the stranger on the shore tells him that Jesus has come looking for him. In the grip of real failure in our lives, we can be very reluctant, can't we, to come and confess our sin to God and even more to each other. What will God think of me? Actually, what will other people think of me? I'm going to read, actually verbatim pretty much, a page from a magazine that I received a few weeks ago, because I think this is brilliant stuff, and it's about the confession of sin. And what the writer Colin Brooks says is this: confession is essentially a matter of putting your hand up and saying out loud, "I cannot keep up." Whatever area we're struggling in, self-esteem, money, sex, caring for the poor, confession is saying to others, "I don't know about you, but I'm not keeping up in this area of my life." Now, far from being a shameful thing, doesn't that sound to you like a courageous and noble thing to do? Far from being something we connect with feeling ashamed, confessing our sin to others, speaking out where we haven't kept up with what God has called us to, should be something that we associate with being strong and brave. When a man comes to me and confesses that he's hooked on pornography, or a woman tells me how she struggles with anger, or a teenager confides their self-loathing, or a parent tells how just at the moment they hate their children, I look at them and I admire them. And whatever I thought of them before, they now soar in my estimation because they desire the things of God more than their pride or their reputation. As Jesus put it in Matthew 13, they've seen a pearl of great value and will give up anything and everything to have it. They want to be free and they've got the guts to do something about it. They've decided, I want the things of God's kingdom and I don't care what I have to lose to get them. Now, if my reaction to confession is admiration, how much more merciful and embracing is the reaction of our perfect Father in heaven? Remember the Proverbs verse says, those who confess and renounce their sins find mercy. Now, the Hebrew word for mercy here is racham. It means loving compassion or tender affection. It isn't the reaction of someone who's remote. We're letting you off with a caution this time. It isn't the reaction of someone who quite like you to feel bad at least for a while. I'm not angry, I'm just very disappointed in you. It's the reaction of an impossibly generous, tender, adoring Father who says, well done for being honest. Now rest in my mercy. We walk around weighed down by the shame of our sins. Yet what Father God invites us to do, like the people at the end of the book of Ezra, is to confess our sins, to get them out, to speak them out, to say, okay, the truth is I've fallen behind and now I can't keep up. There, I've said it. It's out. And when we do, we find mercy. And one final thing. We need to get back into the race because three times Jesus says, feed my lambs, care for my sheep, feed my sheep. Peter, pick up the reins of leadership again. Fulfill the mission that I've called you to. You're down, but you're not out because I won't let you be. It's time to admit the truth, to receive grace, to pick up the baton and re-enter the race. I was in two minds how to finish this sermon. I was sort of drawn to the idea of inviting folks to come forward as if you feel that you're in a place of being a total failure. And I thought that's cruel. And I'm not actually going to do that. But I do want to give an opportunity for response. And I think we'll do this in the less public way. At the end, there is prayer ministry, and there are all sorts of reasons why folks will want prayer ministry. Might be for healing, might be for situations that we're dealing with, but whatever. But if God has spoken to you this morning, I want to encourage you, please. When we come to the end of the final song, would you come forward? Would you allow others to pray with you? Even if you're not in a place where you want to spell out what is the area of failure, just to be able to say to the guys, I'm not keeping up. I'm not hacking it. And I would appreciate prayer. If God's spoken to you this morning, please don't leave it. Please do something with it. And just before the band come up, we're just going to take a moment. I think I'm not even going to lead us in prayer, but just give a little bit of quiet space for us to be able to say, God, this is where I am, and I need your mercy. And I would love for you to put me back on my feet again in serving you. And encourage the band just to come forward as they lead us in the last song, which actually in the face of it is not an awful lot to do with what I've been talking about, but it does actually affirm that the last word in God's purpose is not our failure. It's not us, it's God. It's his sufficiency, it's his grace, his mercy. The dynamic of his grace.